Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. I came across this particular article and my jaw dropped. A very exciting new hope for treating Ebola. Those of you who have not been in a cave for the last 5 or 10 years will recognize the name Ebola. It's a very serious virus. Primarily, thank God, we've only had a few cases in the United States, and these were imported by people who were doing relief work. However, the Ebola virus is a very lethal bug. Around 3 out of every 4 people who contract Ebola die. That's a 75% lethality rate. And that's with things like IV fluid and support. This is a very, very contagious bug as well. And so it's a pretty, pretty terrible thing. We definitely don't want it to get loose. There have been vaccines tried and also treatments that effectively are antibodies against Ebola, but they are serum antibodies. They have to be derived from the blood of people who've survived Ebola, so, you know, that's hard to get. There are a couple of, as I said, experimental agents, but these need to be given promptly. This study looked at 700 people, and they used 2 new drugs, monoclonal antibodies. The one that had the biggest effect, called REGN-EB3, reduced the number of deaths from 75% to 6%. Now, this was in people who had recently been infected, but this is massive. And these were experimental drugs. There was a second one called MAB-114. That also reduced mortality to about 11%. This is huge. And now you can imagine everyone at the World Health Organization and elsewhere is going to be putting in a lot of effort to try to scale this up and make this drug widely available. It is a extremely, extremely important. Another interesting thing that happened in the last week was sex selection. We talked about this last week briefly, but something else came up. So just to remind you, in case you didn't catch last week's show, it turns out that sperm, female sperm, sperm that carry that X chromosome instead of the Y chromosome and will make females, that DNA isn't silent. It's actually being expressed. Some of the genes on the X chromosome are displayed on the surface of the X chromosome, and that means they can be attacked by a drug. And when you attack them, it affects the energy generation in that sperm and makes that sperm swim more slowly. So in a dish of the little wigglers, you can separate out the males from the females, and therefore, by taking sperm literally only from one side of the petri dish, you increase your probability of having male offspring by about 90%. And this is something that could be done fairly cheaply. Turns out you can also scrub the chemical off of the female sperm and get an 81% chance of female babies. Obviously, this will be abused. I did not know this, but sex selection is banned for non-medical uses in the United Kingdom, Australia, Canada, China, and India, interesting about the China, but is legal in most other countries, including the U.S. The idea that we might be able to use this on people for sex selection may lead to some problems. In China, under the one-child policy, there was an alarming rise of accidental death in female babies, leading to a very disproportionate male-to-female ratio in the current young person's population. In fact, they're having to import females to China. This is an interesting phenomenon. It is, however, extremely useful in animal husbandry And so this sort of technology could have a lot of benefit. It's also very interesting to think if you could select the sex of your child by a simple measure of simply doing artificial insemination, would you do so? I'd be interested in your opinion about that and also the why behind it. Another new drug coming along, this one also very promising, a chlamydia vaccine. It's shown to be, it's gotten past its first test of safety in humans. We have a real problem with chlamydia. I was just looking at public health data here in our own Santa Cruz County, because I'm copied on all of that by virtue of my role in our community. And the data on chlamydia is bad. It's actually gone up about 12% over the last couple of years. Everything else and that has dropped, and that includes HIV and gonorrhea, but chlamydia is on the rise. So this drug, it's called CTH522. They always give them such catchy names, but don't worry, the focus group for Big Pharma will come up with something nicer. Nomidia comes to mind. 35 women, 19 to 45, were given the vaccine or a placebo. And over the course of each 5 months, they either got these as shots. They also got nasal spray, and that got my attention, because if you can get nasal spray to work for vaccination, particularly some in adults, I think that's going to be very effective. Women who received the vaccine did demonstrate a vigorous immune response. This was published in The Lancet Infectious Disease last month. So similar side effects to regular vaccines, like soreness at the injection site or a little inflammatory reaction. The phase two trials, now that we've got the safety thing out of the way, let's figure out the dose, how many shots, what the vaccine, and whether, and this I think is huge, this can be pegged to the HPV vaccine schedule. Because we're preventing, and its data is now clear, no question about it, we are preventing cervical cancer with this vaccination. And we're probably also preventing some cases of penis cancer, which is fairly rare in this culture, but is at increased risk in uncircumcised males. So, and maybe rectal or anal cancer in people who do anal receptive intercourse. I haven't seen that data. And most certainly, this HPV vaccine is going to reduce the cases of oral cancer, of squamous cell carcinoma of the mouth, which, with the change in sexual practices that happened in the 1970s and the introduction of more oral sex as a social norm, we have seen that those young men are getting more oral cancer, especially if they use oral tobacco or snuff or anything like that. But even the smokers, we're seeing high rates of squamous cell carcinoma in the mouth. This is a horrible cancer because you have to remove it, and often you're removing a part of the tongue or a part of the palate. It's very disabling to your speech and to many other aspects of normal living, like swallowing. So it's a big deal to be eliminating this really devastating cancer. Maybe we'll also hitch chlamydia on for the ride. And of course, it hitches a ride often enough that we'd love to stop it in its tracks. So let's go to a little bit longer story. Basically, everything has a microbiome. And this is a study about the microbiome of food processing factories and how that has a profound effect on infection by Listeria monocytogenes, which is the most common foodborne pathogen, and it's a real problem. It loves to climb into your child's applesauce, for example. It loves that white cheese that, and once it gets in to a food processing plant, it's hard to get it out. So researchers were wondering why this could be and got some funding and went after looking at the microbiome of the food processing plants. And something really interesting emerged. They looked at three different tree fruit packing facilities in the Northeast where contamination with Listeria monocytogenes had been a concern. This was done in collaboration with the apple industry, and this is very important work because the more highly processed a food, the more massively processed, the larger the factory, even something as healthy as, say, microgreen salad, okay, that's grown in dirt. It has to be processed. It has to be washed. And if E. coli hitches a ride on that or hitches a ride on some apples that go into a apple juice, the results can be rather devastating for large numbers of the population. And sometimes lethal, because if you're very old or very young, this Listeria can kill you. So a packing plant that had a higher rate of Listeria monocytogenes was found to have these harmless bacteria, which are called the Pseudomonasidae, and they are considered to be part of the normal microflora of humans, by the way, and they're harmless. The fungal and a fungal family called Diplodaceae, which I know nothing about except it's a cool name, these bugs were found in high prevalence in the plants that had the Listeria. And what they learned in investigating their properties was that these are very good biofilm formers. So they think that these harmless microorganisms were building themselves a little coral reef. It's made of slime, but it's effectively a place to hide, a place to live. And this reef was being colonized by the Listeria, which was then resisting sterilization. Biofilm is a slimy material. Anyone who's ever had something go bad, like, well, for example, I was going through my salad this morning and pulling out some leaves that were looking a little slimy. That's biofilm. And even though the bugs making it are harmless, it acts to set up a hiding place. It's been awfully difficult to clean biofilm. And in large industrial food processing plants, things like the shape of the conveyors or how the food is moved or sliced and how easy it is to clean the things that do that make a big difference. And not now that we understand that biofilm is an issue, the question then becomes, well, we can restructure the physical slicing and dicing of the plant, try to clean it more often. We can look for enzymatic products that clear biofilm. And I want to put out a word for the fact that people with chronic prostatitis and chronic sinusitis, often why it's chronic and why it keeps coming back is that they have a biofilm that has been built inside their body by these bacteria and fungi. And as long as that biofilm is there, you can't get into it with oral or IV antibiotics. So you knock down the population of bacteria, but you don't quite wipe it out. In natural medicine, we'll often use high doses of plant enzymes because these things can get in to the bloodstream and into the lymphatics directly through the gut, and they seem to break up some of the biofilm. I also often will use I will use things like colloidal silver, not in the human gut, but sometimes if I can get it directly into the sinuses with lavage, and I think that's very helpful at sterilizing those biofilms, so I do recommend it. Obviously, if you're going to use enzymes, you want to use them on an empty stomach, and some people can't tolerate that because it causes upset stomach. So if everything has a biofilm, how does that biofilm get affected by something, well, rather intriguing, like going off into space? I'll be telling you that in just a moment. Let's take this email now from Tim in Funk, Nebraska. Gotta love the name. And Tim's email, I'm a 48-year-old male, 6'1", and weigh about 240 pounds. My doctor sent me a letter saying my total cholesterol is 167, triglycerides 227, and he wants them lowered to less than 150. HDL is 40, LDL is 82, and they want it lower than 70 because I'm a diabetic person. My A1C is 5.8. That means he's a very well-controlled diabetic. He wants to start me on a statin, but muscle soreness when I tried them last time makes me want to avoid this. They also suggested Zetia, and I try to eat low fat because if I eat something fatty at night, it gives me stomach pain in the middle of the night. Tim, that's probably gallstones. You want to get an ultrasound. As far as the Zetia is concerned, let me just share with you a little bit of information. Zetia lowers cholesterol by changing your absorption of cholesterol in the intestine. It's fairly well tolerated, but there is literally no data. In fact, there is tons of data saying it does not change the risk of heart attack. So you can lower your cholesterol, and that's kind of like cheating on the test and getting an A. It doesn't do you any good. I never did that, never. And what does you good when you're trying to lower your triglycerides is shifting your diet. And it sounds to me like you could stand a little bit more healthy fat with maybe a little bit of bile or pancreatic assistance from enzymes, but you also really, really need to get less carbohydrate, less starch, less sugar in your diet. And you're probably doing fairly well right now, but I can tell by that triglyceride of 227 that your insulin levels are up, because that's not normal, especially in a person eating a low-fat diet. So the reason you have triglycerides of 227 is because you have high levels of insulin. You might want, rather than going after this directly, and certainly if statins make your muscles ache, you need to avoid them. And I'll come back to that in a moment. You might try using cinnamon, alpha-lipoic acid, and metformin is the drug that I would look at in you to see if we could get those triglycerides down. And I do agree with your doctor that 150 is a good level. An LDL of 82, honey, the marginal benefit in a diabetic who's not had a heart attack is unproven. This is a number that gets printed on a lab slip, and the doctors are following it because it's printed on the lab slip and they don't want to ignore it. But honestly, there isn't a lot of data that says that you need to give a statin to a diabetic with an LDL under 82 who doesn't have heart disease. So maybe what you need is a treadmill test. Maybe you need to get some advanced lipid testing, something called a phospholipase A2 test, which is available through Quest. That test will tell you if you're making plaque, if you're putting at with that LDL of 82, whether you're actually putting plaque. The other thing that your doctor needs to be doing is helping you get your hsCRP below 1, if possible, because that's where the injury to the arteries that causes the heart disease comes from. And that's why statins work and Zetia don't, is because the statins are anti-inflammatory. And we now understand this. We understand that this is an inflammation problem, and statins work because they're anti-inflammatory, not because they lower cholesterol. And the fact that Zetia doesn't do a thing to lower your risk of a first heart attack is also proof of this. Maybe we should go ahead and talk to our first caller, and that is Bill in Santa Cruz.
Yeah, well, howdy.
Hi there. How you doing?
I'm doing better now that I talk with you.
Okay, well, let's not get hasty here. You better ask your question first.
Well, I have two. One of them has to do with allegation that soy and its derivatives, I don't even understand how Bragg's, you know, the soy.
Mm-hmm. Bragg's aminos or something, yeah.
Yeah, it says it's straight. So, well, why is it so salty? But my real question has to do with, is soy said to be an endocrine disruptor or a hormone disruptor? And the other question is palm oil. I mean, I know half of Africa and Southeast Asia is turned over to palm plantations. That's a drag. But palm oil, how bad is it? And, of course, how about that soy question? Is it an endocrine disruptor? I'll take my answer off the phone.
All right, Bill. We'll start with the endo disruptor,
yeah,
and then we'll pivot to the palm oil. Oh,
soy,
I like that.
Soy and palm.
All right. Well, starting with endocrine disruptors, that's not a real medical term or a scientific term. I see it as kind of a political term. So I'll often use the word hormone mimic because, as you know, mimics are not the real thing. Sometimes a mimic will substitute for the real time thing, and sometimes it'll just fool you into thinking you've got the real thing. And so a good example would be, say, saccharin, which mimics sweetness but doesn't give you any energy. So I like hormone mimic. And let's talk about the different kinds of hormone mimics that are out there. We have the artificial compounds that are coming from plastic. They're in the fire retardants. There's the the polyphenols. There's all of these new-to-nature molecules, which just happen to fit into hormone receptors. And among other things, these forms of hormone mimics raise the chances of getting obesity and diabetes. So those, I am like BPA in water bottles, right? And phthalates that used to be in pacifiers and all, and the fire retardants in children's pajamas and the stuff in the foam that, you know, we're so cool here in California. We made these really strict laws, and we, if you make a really strict law and you're a really big market, then the companies find it cheaper to just switch to your laws and sell that everywhere than to make two different sets of products and destine one set for California. So being a large, I think we're still the fifth or sixth largest economy on the planet, last I checked, that gives us a lot of marketing leverage in this state. And long may we wave, because among other things, we've helped clean up the air in this country. And unfortunately, there's always a downside. We also put a lot of fire retardant into foam rubber in furniture, which as the foam rubber deteriorates, the fire retardant turns into tiny micro particles, which we breathe and act as hormone disruptors. Oops. So I'm going a little bit far afield, but I wanted to give you that because if you think of hormone mimics rather than endocrine disruptors, then you can see how plastic fits in here. But plastic doesn't necessarily mess up your estrogen or your progesterone. Now, soy has molecules in it. Now, soy is a food, and there are hundreds of different protein-shaped proteins in soy. And genistein and daisin, I may not be pronouncing those right, are two compounds that I know for a fact will fit into female estrogen receptors. And this is an interesting story. These are natural compounds. They have hormone-like properties. If you eat, if you're into natural progesterone and you're buying natural progesterone for sleep and rubbing it on your body, you're buying Mexican wild yam that has been doctored biochemically to create a molecule that is identical to human progesterone. They just have to do a little clip and clip here and clip there enzymatically, and they've got progesterone. So it's a natural human hormone derived from a potato, basically. So coming back to soy, so these compounds look like estrogen enough to sit on the estrogen receptor. Is that bad? Well, if you are a postmenopausal woman who's taking hormone, who's taking therapy, or a man, let's say, with prostate cancer, who's taking hormone blockers to avoid having any estrogen or testosterone in your body, then soy could be bad for you, because you might get some hormone effect from it and essentially bypass the protection that you're supposed to be getting from these chemotherapy agents, this hormone exclusion therapy. On the other hand, we know from studies in Japan that Japanese people get fewer cases of breast cancer. And yeah, that might be the amount of animal stuff in the diet. But then when you look at people who migrate from Japan to the United States, if they migrate after puberty, the women are still protected. If they migrate before puberty, they are not protected, and their cancer rates for breast cancer are pretty much equivalent to the Caucasian population. Now, the only difference in here is, did they get soy during puberty? And we now think that if you are female, and when your ovaries start busting out with all that estrogen and your breasts start blossoming, if you've got a little soy on board, you don't get quite as vigorous a response, and that protects you from breast cancer for the rest of your life. Now, if you're a woman who has lots of tenderness in her breasts with her periods, if you have a history of endometriosis or fibroids, a very curvy body, that's a woman who might actually benefit from soy and find it protective during her premenopausal years for breast cancer. So it's not simple. You have to know the context when you ask the question. And unfortunately, people are kind of simple, and they are kind of direct. They want it black and white. They get lost when you try to discuss something that's nuanced. Not everybody, of course, but when I'm dealing with patients, you know, there's just sort of like, cut to the chase, doc. And I'm like, I can't, because you need to understand this to understand why I'm giving you this advice. And at least professionally, I have to say, if I can get the patient to stick with me for a couple minutes so that they understand why this is a good idea, I get much better follow through from the patient. And I think that makes a modicum of sense. So, moving to palm oil. Palm oil is a saturated fat, and there are good saturated fats and bad saturated fats. I'm more of a fan of coconut oil. Palm oil has a very deleterious effect on the environment, and we're facing an environmental crisis right now. So, from a health standpoint, the biggest risk of palm oil, in my opinion, is not the cardiovascular disease. It's the global warming and the fact that you stand a chance of ending up in a refugee camp with a cholera outbreak. Statistically speaking, we do not want mass migrations. We do not want people losing their homes and ending up in shelters because of dastardly weather conditions or fires or. And so let's quit cutting down the rainforest. It would be a really good idea to essentially not buy products with palm oil, because the broader eco-health consequences have a substantial blowback onto your chances of living to a ripe old age. So let's just buy something else. I'm going to take some time to talk about recent research about the microbiome and space flight. So you may have heard about Scott Kelly. By the way, his twin brother, Mark, the astronaut Scott, both of them are astronauts. Mark is married to Gabby Giffords and is running for McCain's old seat in Arizona Senate. So that'll be an interesting election to watch. Anyway, so Mark and Scott, being twin brothers, identical twins, they did an experiment. Mark stayed home and Scott went to space and lived there for a year. Scott kept drawing his blood and collecting his urine and sending it back down for studies. And a lot of interesting changes took place that are worth alluding to for a moment. Mr. Kelly's telomeres got longer rather than decreasing, but they think that was due to an increase in the supply of stem cells, which may have been a result of the extra radiation. So we're not really sure if that was good or bad. What we do know is that the telomeres reverted after he got back and was here for a few months. So it's probably some kind of protective response. A lot of genes changed. Thousands of genes that were quiet and remained quiet in brother Mark turned on in Scott. And a lot of these were genes that are known to be DNA repair genes, which makes sense because there's a lot of radiation. Some of them were just immune response genes, inflammatory. But recent studies also show that there are many latent viruses, which when you're in a gravity field, stay latent. But when we go into space, they wake up and start reproducing. But some species of bacteria shifted in the microbiome. And that's really extraordinarily intriguing. Certain species got more prevalent and other species got less prevalent. And you could say, and I immediately, when I heard this, thought, you know, that's probably just diet. I mean, you know, he's eating astronaut food and his brother is down here on Earth and he's eating people food, normal, standard American diet food, likely. Well, I hope not, but for his sake. But anyway, the point is divergence in diet equals divergent in microbiome. But this study calls that into question. This came out, just published. It's Northwestern University, and they created a tool called StarMaps, Similarity Test for Accordant and Reproducible Microbiome Abundance Patterns. And then they ran essentially DNA fingerprints on three groups of mice. One little group stayed home and lived in a controlled environment that had exactly the same food that the space mice got and the same gas mix of, so artificial air, same as the group on the space station, and same facility, basically same house, same food, same air. And they had a third group that was just baseline cage mice, and they looked at what happened in the microbiomes, and there were substantial shifts in which genera were abundant and which were not, and new microbiome patterns that we'd seen previously on space flights, because they've been studying this for a while, but they haven't had a control group. What they found looking at this was the microbiomes from space looked very different than the two on the ground. And here's where it's crazy. Compared to Scott Kelly, the ratios of the same major types of bacteria changed in the same direction, and the same increase in overall diversity occurred. Although it weren't exactly the same species, it was basically the same thing. So you can imagine, you know, two completely different Toyotas. One's a truck, one's a compact. They both have airbags and tires and gear shifts and all the things that are standard in cars, but they're sized a little bit different. They do the same job, but it's not the same tool. And if you think of the microbiomes of mice and humans like that, you know, a gear shift's a gear shift, but the gear shift from the compact won't fit into the truck. But you can make some statements about that particular part. And if it changes when you go to space, well, that's important. And as we start thinking about long-term space travel, all of this data, including the space mice, are super, super important. We got a comment, I'm not sure how it came in, from Roseanne, possibly email. And I'm not sure that I believe it, and I'm not sure I understand where you're getting this, Roseanne. So I would really encourage you, since we do have time, to give us a call here. There's time to talk. Okay, so most people are severely low in magnesium. Yeah, I agree with that. It's one of the first minerals depleted in our soils. Yes. So it transports every mineral and other vitamin stored around your body. Well, it's important in all of cellular physiology, and it isn't really, strictly speaking, a transporter. It's a signal modulator, and it's an important cofactor in many enzymatic reactions. So no doubt magnesium is very, very important, and if you are growing food in, you know, highly organic soil, you're better off than if you're getting food that's been conventionally grown. But the soil isn't normally, when it's fertilized, you don't put the magnesium back. And we don't generally use human poop. Probably the best thing to do would be to throw some powdered magnesium into fertilizer, but then you'd have to retool the fertilizer plant. So we're probably not going to see that. The statement I am not clear on, Roseanne, is you wrote in your email, that don't take vitamin D3 as it uses up the magnesium, and that one should use a natural source of D like sunshine or cod liver oil. And I'm kind of scratching my head about that, and don't understand the mechanism. Vitamin D is a hormone, and, magnesium is not consumed by vitamin D. That's just not human physiology. That's not anybody's physiology. They're operating at two different orders of magnitude, really. So I'd have to say in reply to your email that this doesn't make sense to me. I'm open to talking to you if you want to call. But when I look at this, this sounds like some internet meme or some, you know, Townsend letter, you know, article that someone put up there and threw a bunch of references. And I will criticize the Townsend letter for this, because now that I have the internet, I'll often go and look up the references. You know, you'll get some article and I'll read it and go, God, that's a contrarian viewpoint. Let me check these references that purport to say that this says that. And then I'll go and dig down and look at the references. And it's like, you know, that actually doesn't say that. And you're using it to support a declarative statement and referencing the declarative statement. But then when I go look in the article, it doesn't establish your declarative statement. It isn't supportive. And so that's an old kind of dodge that goes back in scientific papers to the days before the internet. But now it's a little easier to debunk, but it still takes time and energy. All I want to say is that does not make sense to me. Please give me a call. And if you find something out there that doesn't make sense to you, I'd love to talk to you. The number to call, 957-73. New Molecule is out. This is interesting bit of research, and this is something that could really help improve heart attack recovery. So when a person has a heart attack, blood flow is stopped to a part of the heart. There's roundabouts. I often refer to my gardening and my drip system in my garden. Every spring I have to get out there and revascularize and perform bypasses on my drip system. And you could think of the heart as having a kind of very sophisticated backup plan, but ultimately, if one of those 5-gallon emitters is not working, I'm going to have some dead stuff, and that would be dead heart muscle. So when a heart muscle is dying, it sends out signals that actually cause the shutdown of healthy cells in the vicinity. This is called the bystander effect, and people have been looking long and hard to find a way to block it. About a decade ago, Dr. Gordy, who's the publisher here of this latest research, or excuse me, the author of this latest study published in the Journal of the American Heart Association. So Dr. Gordy and his his postdoc were bumbling around the lab and studying the activity of channels in cells that affects the bystander effect. And they found a compound called alpha-CT1 that looked like it was blocking the bystander effect. And that was cool. But one of the other things it did was it had really beneficial effects for wound healing. So chronically inflamed wounds don't heal. And like diabetic ulcers that eventually lead to amputation, this is a big deal. So they founded a company. Yes, let's build a startup. First String Research. And they have spent 10 years commercializing this stuff. It's now in phase 3 clinical trials for treating wounds, which means it'll be FDA approved soon. So now they thought, what else can we do with this? Where else is there a big market? How about heart attacks? So they tried a bunch of different molecules and they found one that is extremely effective. It's a slight derivative of the original molecule called alpha-CT11, and it blocks the bystander effects, and it can be given up to 20 minutes after the ischemic injury. So in other words, if they had this stuff in the ambulance when you called 911 or rolled into the ER with chest pain, they might be able to give this to you, and it would protect the heart even after the ischemic injury, reduce the amount of damage, and quite possibly make huge difference in whether or not the person actually went on to have what we would even call a heart attack. So pretty huge. And now the question is, how do you get it into the heart? Now they're using little lipid droplets. You may have heard of liposomes. Well, exosomes are tiny, naturally derived lipid baggies, if you will, and you can load anything you want into that baggie. And when it hits a cell, it'll stick to the cell, zip a hole in the cell, fuse, and dump its contents into the inside of the cell. You may have seen Tom the Bubble Man in Santa Cruz at one time or another, putting bubbles inside of bubbles. This is exactly what you can do with lipid bilayers. And we'll have more later in the program on exosomes. But now we're going to go to our caller who heard us out there in New Jersey. Hello, Roseanne.
Hello there, Dr. Dawn.
Hi, thanks for calling and thanks for listening live on the internet. That's really cool.
Yes, and I sent you the email about the magnesium and D3, and in the bottom of the email, I had copy and pasted that a while back from something that I read, and I thought this cannot be true, so I waited to talk, email you and ask you about it.
I think it's... Go ahead. Sorry.
Yeah, I don't know where I got it from, but you mentioned Townsend.
Right. Townsend Letter, it's a magazine that's very alternative, and some of the stuff I agree with, some of it is very, very out there in alternative land. It's kind of a spectrum. I like stuff that's backed up by science. I'm kind of, if it's Ayurvedic and it's got a long history, I'll honor it, but I might not necessarily mix and match it with Western medicine because I don't know that it's been investigated in combination. If someone wants to do nothing but Chinese medicine, I'm down with that. I probably would encourage them to work with someone who's very skilled and sophisticated in that. And I do think these traditional forms of medicine are legitimate and have been, but they are validated in, you know, by the time-honored, you know, it works and it stays in the system, kind of a natural selection process rather than by our sort of deductive reasoning scientific approach. So it's, but then there are lots of things that in these journals that are really contrarian, kind of in the everything you know is wrong sort of approach. And you see that a lot. I'm thinking, and I, with all due respect to the religious faith of Jehovah's Witnesses, I remember actually talking to Jehovah's Witnesses and it's like, oh no, the Bible's wrong. You know, that wasn't a cross, that was a post. And I'm like, well, okay, I mean, you know what I'm saying, right? It, so you can make a declarative statement and then you can point to some, well, it was a problem, it was a mistranslation. And it's like, okay, fine, but yeah, I need more data. And of course, with religious matters, that's one thing. But when you're talking about health and disease, you know, there are methods of validation that exist outside of the holy books here. And I feel that we should be using them. But I know my physiology. And this is like saying that that a fly is going to hit an airliner and have an effect. So the magnesium ion is the fly, and the vitamin D3 molecule is the airplane. And, you know, if they fight, if the fly fights with the airplane, the fly always loses. So,
definitely.
Now, vitamin D, let me just say, if you go out and hit the beach every day, like you're a lifeguard or something, and you, you'll make about 10,000 IUs of vitamin D a day. Now you'll, and I'm, this is starting to emerge in the scientific literature. People are saying, you know, high doses of vitamin D may interfere with bones and may cause osteoporosis. And I'm like, okay, let me go look at that study. And it's always the injections of 50,000 units of vitamin, of 50,000 IUs of vitamin D once a week. And that's like saying, well, if I take, if let's suppose that you are on estrogen replacement therapy and you don't want to take a pill every day and you don't want to use a patch, you just want to get a shot once a month of estrogen. And it would average out, right, to the same amount of estrogen that you'd be getting in from your patch or your cream. Wrong, because estrogen's a signal. It's a hormone. Hormones are signals. And they have a right level and a wrong level. If I take a if I take all of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony and I collapse it into one loud blast of noise, that is not going to convey to you the nuance and excitement of the symphony. That is a highly ornate, detailed, complex piece of information. And you can't just deliver it in one big blast and communicate anything. And so when we do a big blast of a hormone, it's actually dangerous. And I try to talk everybody out of these 50,000 units a week for their, you know, for whatever you're treating, hyperparathyroidism or whatever you think you're treating, you're probably messing up a whole bunch of other complex communication structures because you're not, you're delivering, you know, the alphabet, but you're not delivering it in a way that makes any sense to the, for the communication.
I love your analogies.
Thank you.
I really do. I learned so much more that way. And that was great. I take D3 for a long time. I take 5,000.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's about
and,
right.
Yeah. And, you know, that's all you're hearing about is D3 and the wonders and, you know, all that stuff. So to see that like this, and I don't believe everything I read, that's why I come to you for my second opinion.
Why, thank you. I think, you know, the contrarian thing, I think that's what's going on here. So vitamin D, 5,000, pretty safe. Some people might hyperabsorb. That's unusual. I think I've seen it once. And I think this guy, I had one guy who came in at 115, and I'm like, okay, how much vitamin D are you taking? He's, oh, 15,000 units a day. For how long? Oh, 5 years. I'm like, okay, that's too much. You know, let's keep it in the range that is physiologically achievable under, you know, wild type circumstances, like the lifeguard on the beach. If you stay within the range that happens to wild type humans on the planet, you're probably in the safe range. So I don't megadose things unless I'm really sure of the results, and I figure I'm weaponizing a drug when I give it in really super physiologic amounts. I don't consider, like iodine, for example, some people, you know, some naturopaths use 25 milligrams of iodine. And I think that's too much. We have studies that show that'll suppress the thyroid in healthy military recruits. I sure don't want to do it in, you know, a small woman at that level because, you know, we know that 17-year-old strapping, you know, Marines are getting thyroid problems from it. Let's not use that dose. But what I do is I look at, what do people eat in Japan? If they eat a whole lot of seaweed, what's a standard consumption? And the consumption in that country by that people is, 5 to 8 milligrams at the max. So I kind of put a lid on it. And I say, I'm not going past what the Japanese eat. Now, we know that we can do this because whenever there's a nuclear explosion, Chernobyl, Fukushima, we give people a big wonkin dose of iodine. And we do that to saturate their thyroid with a non-radioactive iodine so the thyroid's incapable of absorbing any of the radioactive iodine. So even if you swallow it, it goes right through you. It bounces off your breasts and it bounces off your thyroid gland because it's full. There's no place for it to grab. And when we do that, we do get a transient drop in thyroid function in those people, but it sure beats thyroid cancer 15 years out. So that is something, by the way, that I know when we had the Fukushima thing, I got a little nervous about radioactive iodine, and I went out and got myself a supply that I could hand out to patients. And the stuff is cheap, except when there's a problem. So to the doctors and nurses who are out there, who like the idea of disaster preparedness, I think we should have some iodine around that we can hand out to friends and family in the event that a suitcase bomb in San Francisco or something like that,
When you mentioned 25 milligrams, I have a box that someone gave me of liquid iodine plus. She loves this stuff. And this is 150 mcgs.
Right, right. And that's micrograms. Five milligrams is 5,000 micrograms. So the 150, that's what the FDA says is your minimum daily requirement. Guess what that's supposed to do? It's supposed to prevent you from getting a goiter. It does. It's the minimum. It's the minimum dose you need to take so that you don't get a goiter, which is a deficiency disease caused by too little iodine. And back when they made this number, that's all they knew about the thyroid. They knew that you got goiters if there wasn't any iodine. You mentioned magnesium depletion in the soils earlier in your email, but magnesium depletion of iodine depletion in the soils naturally in the United States was a huge problem until they started putting iodine in the salt, which is around the 1920s. Prior to that, the entire Midwest had quote-unquote epidemic goiter. 1 out of 10 people had a goiter because they were growing their food, they were using crop rotation, they were doing, cover crops and stuff, the progressive farming before we got chemical fertilizers and started to mess things up. But they all had goiters because there just isn't any way to get the iodine into the soil. So they said, how much salt do people use? And this is back in the days of corned beef and salt as a preservative. And they figured that the 150 micrograms, and so they put enough of iodine in the salt to, that the average person was going to get that 150. And now we put it in all of our multivitamins. So I see very few goiters, certainly very few.
Right, yeah.
Go ahead.
Go ahead.
I wanted to ask you.
I have this.
Let me go. Okay. Because I wanted to throw in another question. You had emailed me a couple weeks ago about your brother-in-law with a 105 fever, and he'd been in the hospital three times with the same thing. And the doctor did three cultures. What was the bacteria? Because I couldn't work with that email. I didn't even use it. Because
I know.
I was like, sorry. What was the bacteria? Because you got to know
this
that.
This is my brother-in-law, and I called my sister the next day, and I told her what information you wanted. So I said to her, this is your job. Go and get me the information. So she has to go to the doctors and get the information, and then I would get back to you. But his was bladder infections. He was constantly having bladder infections. And she said they told her it was a soft tissue infection, and they really did not know where that was coming from, which after listening to your comments last week, I'm like, well, how does that become soft tissue infection? But the doctor did one culture, nothing was coming. He did another, and it was a blood culture, not urine. Mm-hmm. He did another culture, and then on the third culture is where he came up with this. And I just don't know what this
I can guess, and I think I'll be right, is I'm guessing that it's bowel flora, and I'm would be, given it that he's probably an older gentleman, I would be really suspicious that he's got a chronic prostatitis. I talked about how you can build a biofilm in your prostate. And back, I'll just share with you, this was something that we did, we're going to wind up, but let me just give you this one last anecdote.
Sure.
When I was working during my early years of training, and this was in the late 80s, when I was in residency, I worked with this one doctor, and I don't know if you ever saw the movie The Green Mile, but that the chronic prostatitis is what the Tom Hanks character has, and it's really painful, and the psychic guy, you know, the psychic guy cures him, but it's this is pre-antibiotic, and what they used to have to do is they used to go in and they would massage the prostate, kind of like popping a zit. So you'd rub the prostate really hard, and it would hurt like hell because it was inflamed. And then, but that would crush the microbiome and kind of squeeze it out into the urethra. And so you could reduce the inflammation and slow the rate of recurrence. And then once we got antibiotics, the combination of prostate massage and antibiotics did a great deal. That's all we have time for today, but keep listening,
sure.
Roseanne. Really,
yes,
really appreciate it.
Yes, and I will get back to you when I get more.
All right.
I love listening to you. Listen to you all day. Okay, thank
bye
you, Dr.
Now.
Dawn.
Bye for now.
Okay, bye-bye.
Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.